Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Okay. Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into early stage UK-based technology companies, and we're going to be doing that with the CEO of Cinven Capital, Keelan Doyle. We're going to be looking at their current raise on Republic at this point in time, and we're going to be drilling down into the Cinven Technology EIS Fund. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce you all to Keelan Doyle. Keelan, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Well, Jonathan, it's a pleasure to be here.
Really looking forward to this conversation, Keelan. It's a particularly interesting area. Although the UK public markets aren't known for their technology companies, one area the UK is very strong is the early stage technology companies. So that's what we're going to be discussing today. We're going to be looking at the Cinven Fund, and we're also going to be looking at your raise, looking at some of your portfolio companies, ones you've invested in, ones you've exited, and where you see opportunities in the market. But before we get started, it would be great, Keelan, if you could give us an introduction, first of all, to yourself as well as Cinven Capital, please.
Yes, well, I'm Keelan Doyle, CEO and co-founder of Cinven Capital. Cinven Capital, I founded with my co-founder, Nicholas Nicolaides, in 2013, although we launched our first fund in 2014. So we've been going a little while. We're very performance-oriented rather than, so I think the fund management side leads the company more than the marketing side. We're not, of course, we're a marketing company, but we're not entirely marketing-led. We're very much focused on investor performance. So since we started, we've made 60 investments. We have between 50 and 60 million pounds in assets under management, 800 subscribers. We've invested in 100 founders. We've had 6 exits. And perhaps the most important point, and one that we stress because I will talk a little bit later about how we differentiate from our rivals, we have at present a 5.18% EIS loss rate, which is phenomenal by market standards. There was a BBC article last week, which was indicating that anywhere up to 80% of UK startups fail within 3 years. So that's very low, but I don't think we can keep it that low because it's phenomenal. I mean, even under 25% is phenomenal, but we're trying. Let me outline a little bit about us. We started in the market, although Nick and I have huge amounts of experience. When we first started off in the EIS market, we were seen as a bit Johnny come lately, and we were very different from most of the people in the market at that time. Most people, and you know some of the names, so the larger competitors, they would say, if you give us a pound, we will aim to give you £1.10, right? And we thought, this is rather strange. Given that venture capital is high risk, and everyone understands that, you should be getting a much higher return. So we came into the market promising a £1 turning into £2.85, what we call an average life of 7 years. Now, that can be closer to 10 years in some cases, and that can be closer to 5 in others. But just to give you an idea of when you should be expecting, you know, this is patient capital. And so one wishes to be realistic about what, you know, you want to get an optimal exit. Because at the end of the day, whether that's an exit going the wrong way and you're claiming loss relief, or whether it goes the right way and you're making hopefully a tax-free profit, that's the name of the game. You know, we started off with not a high profile, but I think that's changed over the years. We're on quite a few of the large panels, and we are, you know, for instance, in last November, the sort of flagship for entrepreneurs in the UK is what's called the Great British Entrepreneur Awards, and we won Investor of the Year. So I like to think we're doing something right.
Let's start from the top, if we may. Of course, technology, very broad mandate there. I think I'd like to start with looking in a little bit more detail on the areas of technology that you see value in and you like to invest in. It is a market that is rapidly changing, so it'd be good to really get your insight, and I'm sure listeners will be very interested in this as well, in terms of going a layer deeper and then looking at the technology markets and where you see opportunities and where you like to invest.
Well, perhaps it's better, you know, within technology, there's a lot of different types of technology, and we have a very strong focus on B2B technology software businesses, what they call it, with a SaaS business model. Now, that's not every one of our companies, but it's certainly where we gravitate towards. I'll tell you some of the areas we avoid. We avoid consumer technology, people, you know, making, I don't know, smartwatches or mobiles or something like that, you know, that kind of consumer oriented. We're much more oriented towards enterprise. We also avoid life sciences, mainly because you need to be very specialized, and that's not our area of expertise. And we also avoid university spin-outs, not as a rule, because we have done one or two before, but we're very much, and our background is very much, as Jerry Maguire said, show us the money. We're interested not in, you know, oftentimes in academic, it's more the idea and it's not as crassly commercial, shall we say. So yeah, our sweet spot is B2B technology, often, but not exclusively, with a fintech flavor, but we have various different sectors within that B2B emphasis.
So why is it you avoid the consumer type companies? Is it, you know, driven by your background as a team? Is it the opportunities that you see in the UK within the two different sectors, if we're comparing B2B and consumer? Or do you think that they have a higher chance of success going forward? It'd be really good to get some insight there.
Our feeling, well, A, our expertise and background, you know, we've been working in financial services since early 1990s. So we have a great contact book and a lot of experience. And hence one of the reasons we gravitate towards something like fintech, because we both have worked in large investment banks. We both worked on the AIM market and done a lot of IPOs and a corporate finance background, which is kind of what you want when you want a group who's good at exits. But consumer technology has one outstanding difficulty for us. And that's, I mean, the difficulty for B2B targeting enterprise, like let's say insurance companies or banks or defense contractors or whatever, is the sales cycle can be lengthy. But that's to be expected. But if you're solving the right problem and you know what you're doing, it's a stable, long-term, high value in terms of contract size. The problem with why we avoid consumer anyway, I mean, some people are very good at it. Even if you do invest in something that is game-changing in terms of consumer tech, you've now got to go and build a brand, and that's very expensive, and it's also very time-consuming and costly. So for us, and we're not really that interested in consumer tech, frankly. So all of those combined to lead to our emphasis on B2B.
And I think that approach is very much highlighted by the numbers that you shared at the beginning, Keelan, and that very low failure rates of companies in the portfolio. And we are going to be discussing some of the portfolio companies in more detail a little bit later on in the podcast. But Keelan, we can't speak at this point in time, you know, looking at what's happening out there to the software, but mostly in the public arena, and talk about what's happening in AI. How's that impacting your thinking at the moment? How's that impacting your investment choices?
So, you know, the public can be mistaken for thinking that AI is something that was invented 3 years ago. In fact, it's been around for a lot longer. I had the pleasure and honor, actually, of in December 2024, of being one of a select group of people who were invited to Stockholm for a series of lectures and cocktail parties, frankly, for Geoffrey Hinton, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics at that session, and he's seen as the godfather of AI. So the reason I think, I'm an alumni of the University of Toronto where he's a professor, but I think the other reason why I was invited, because there was a really select group of people, was that I suppose my location in London, but also they know that we've been interested in AI for many, many years and machine learning, its close cousin. In fact, our first machine learning investment was 2008. So we go back quite a way on looking at this. Now, everybody talks about AI. It's the newest buzz. It's real, but it's a lot of people who are talking about it aren't really using it in a way that solves problems. And that's what we fundamentally focus on. You see a lot of businesses that you can't really be a business and say we spent nothing on AI. Of small businesses all the way up to large FTSE 100 companies. But do you know what you're spending on? And are you spending on things that are solving problems? And from an investor point of view, we're looking like investing in companies that harness AI to solve problems, be that in the insurance industry or in the whatever, asset management industry, private banking industry, whatever it is. But, you know, like any of these things, there are always bubbles. And certainly at the large end of the market, we're seeing that bubble start to come off now. I was asked in a research group called Hardman, I did an end of year podcast with a number of people. We got onto the idea, like a lot of people were already then talking about an AI bubble. And I said, yes, there surely will be a correction, and particularly amongst different companies, as you know, some are doing better than others. I said, bubbles are inherently hard to call. But, you know, like for instance, yesterday, based on sort of an AI correction. The granddaddy of tech firms, IBM, fell 11% on Monday alone. And you've seen the other big AI companies, a lot have been getting hammered, and then some will do exceptionally well. But at the lower end of the market, the junior growth tech companies, the venture capital companies, we're always very careful about overvaluation. And, you know, I remember during COVID years, there was such a overvaluation of companies in general, and people paying what we considered 3-4 times fair value. As I would say to my team, there's a difference between a good company and a good investment. If you overpay for a good investment, a good company, should I say, it's not a good investment. So I think that's what people have to be careful about when they're looking at AI. Don't just fall for the hype.
We're going to be looking, as I mentioned, at some of the portfolio companies and possibly how they're putting AI to work a little bit later on. But before we move on and get a little bit more granular in terms of individual holdings and what you're looking for, what would you say, Keelan, sets the Cinven Technology EIS apart from some of the other options that are available to investors at the moment?
Well, I think one of the reasons that, you know, we won the Investor of the Year at the Great British Entrepreneur Awards was our emphasis on transparency, the fact that we don't charge investor fees, and that low failure rate. Now, I want to give you a heads up. That 5% is not going to last. I think it's going to rise to 15 soon because there's two companies that are in a little bit of trouble. Let's see. But 15 is outstanding. I mean, I've seen one of our competitors, actually, one that focuses on university spin-offs, and someone sent me a portfolio that they had invested personally. And that company was only 5 companies. We'll talk about diversification a bit later. 5 companies invested in, and 4 of them failed within 3 years, which I guess is consistent with what the BBC article was saying about how many failures of newcos. And the one that did okay, I think it did 2.5 times, but they took carry on that. And carry is a performance fee of 20% typically in the market. And most people who invested in EIS funds or VCTs know what carry is. Another thing that distinguishes us is we only take carry, what they call aggregate carry. So in other words, in this case, the guy invested 40,000, they returned 19,000, but took part of that 19,000 was 20% on the one company that did well. We wouldn't have done that. We don't take carry until, if they invest £100, it's given back to them. So if we lose money for people, we're not taking a performance fee, because we just don't think that's right. And it aligns our interests with the investor interest by having that approach.
It does indeed. That's a notable difference there. Thank you very much for highlighting that, Keelan. So let's get on to some of the companies now, because I'm sure a lot of listeners are going to be interested in hearing about what's in the portfolio, what you've invested in previously, and also what are you looking for at the moment? What, when you're selecting companies, stands out for you? You've mentioned the certain sectors, you've mentioned what you don't invest, but let's go a little bit deeper now in terms of when you're looking at a company, you might be operating in a sector that you like, it might have a really good disruptive technology, but then when we look a little bit deeper into the companies there, what really do you want to see from a portfolio company before you make an investment?
Okay, well, we talked generally the kind of sector approach, but let me get a bit more granular on the sectors, and then we can talk about some individual companies. So if I look at our portfolio, we have invested in things like fintech, insurtech, wealth management tech, legal tech, reg tech, HR tech, meaning the future of work. We have some things that are a little bit removed from that, like AR and VR. Cybersecurity is an area that we're interested in, as is supply chains and logistics. So that's kind of our broad focus. You know, we get approached all the time with people who have different sector, you know, really interesting looking companies, but they're just not in their sector. So for instance, today I was approached with a platform for the media sector, and we're not media people. I know the guy quite well, and I just said, sorry, it's not our focus. Because one of the things that we're very big on is that you should invest in things that you understand, and you should understand the companies and get involved with them. So when we're looking at companies, we're looking at people obviously who have great tech and who have a great idea, and we believe and understand what they're trying to accomplish in the market. But we also look for resilience, and we look for, frankly, integrity. And the reason for that is sometimes you get a bad apple out there, and we spend a lot of time focusing on the founders and not, hopefully not making mistakes on that front. And sometimes we do make mistakes. But the other thing is resilience, because being an entrepreneur is very hard. You have to be someone who gets knocked down 99 times and is willing to get up for the 100th. And not everybody has that. Some people are more suitable to a different environment because it's not for the faint-hearted.
So you mentioned their resilience, Keelan, which is really interesting. How do you go about gauging that? If you're meeting a founder for the first time, maybe having some follow-up meetings with them, how do you gauge that they are going to be a resilient founder and be able to be knocked down 99 times and get back up again?
Well, obviously, we look into their background and we do a fair amount of due diligence. I think we do quite a bit of due diligence, but due diligence is not just a snapshot in time. It's ongoing. So our approach is quite different. And I say this when I make investor presentations. If I look and I see, a fund who raises $10 million and they put $1 million into each company, that tells me they're not very involved because each company is unique and has different requirements. But what we do when we invest in a company, we invest over multiple tranches. I don't like just cutting a $2 million check to an early stage company and just say, go off and find something to do with that money. I don't think that's really what investors want. It's certainly not what I want. But we spend a lot of time with them at the beginning, and we usually start off with an SEIS investment, and then it leads into an EIS investment. Most of our portfolio is EIS, I'd say 90%. So, sometimes if we make a mistake at a very early stage, we stop investing. So over time, to be honest, the first investment is like a toe in the water. You spend as much time as you can and you're looking at their background, you're looking at your assessment, your gut feel. But then when you're, either on their board as a board observer or a director, that's when you really start to tell, is this a resilient person? Is this an ambitious person? Is this person the right person? So as I say, due diligence is not a snapshot in time. It's an ongoing process.
Thank you. And actually, that's something that we're going to be picking up on and discussing in more detail a little bit later on the podcast. And that's the support that you offer companies and how you work with them afterwards. But before we do that, Keelan, I think it'd be really good now. You've kindly shared the sectors and subsectors that you invest in. It would be good now if we could look at some individual companies within the portfolio, what they're actually doing on the ground and why you like them in the first place, please.
I'll start with a company that's been in our portfolio for a number of years, which is in the insurtech area. And I'll then talk about some of the, and actually will be available for anybody at Republic or in wealth management firms that's looking to invest within the next month, basically, will get access to them. They're called Writingdem. Now, they're a company that basically is, again, using AI, but not just AI, but they are in the area of digitizing insurance claims. Now, when you think of an insurance market, really the product is claims. And sometimes that can be a difficult area. I've had it before where I had a hard time claiming what was clearly covered under the policy. But what Writingdem seek to do is to give the right indemnification, hence the name, and to turn around the claim in an efficient way. And so basically that they can make a decision within sort of 2 or 3 days in the perfect world. Now, complex claims are going to be different. Now, we've had quite some interesting investors, including NN, which is one of the largest insurance companies in Europe, based in the Netherlands. We've got a number of angels that are very sophisticated in the insurance space. We've invested over, 6 or 7 years. And, we've had, you might have heard of Amanda Blanc, who's the CEO of Aviva, probably the most prominent female executive in the UK. She used to be our chairman and only left because Aviva's basically said you have to give up your other non-director positions. But we've since had a number of luminaries, and we're about to bring on a new advisor/chairman who's extremely prominent in the industry. So that's an example of one that we've grown with. We did actually have an offer to buy it for $50 million. That was just before the bear market kicked in. And the private equity guys, I'm not sure, they might have been just saying, we don't want to invest, because they changed the valuation dramatically after we were almost complete the transaction of 6 months. And it was funny because those guys didn't really understand insurance. Most of their focus was on complete consumer markets and things like hotels, etc. But we're confident that other people will buy. We have some really blue chip clients like AA and eSure, WNS, the big, who's just been bought by Capgemini. They're all clients of ours. So that's a more mature company, but it's one that investors would get access to ahead of the tax year. But they'd also get access to one of our other companies in a sector that's rather new to us, but it's a very hot sector. And we've made one investment, but we're going to look to make more. And it's called Mission Decisions in the defense tech area. Another company that I think looks like it's going to be invested in is Pimlock, which is a cybersecurity play and has, the very prestigious Amadeus, the Cambridge-based investor, that venture capital investor that's, very prestigious and people we get on with very well. And not last but least, but I'll just mention one other in the interest of time, and that is a company called Gazelle, which is doing very well, just signed Purple Bricks up as a big client. And what they are doing is working with the estate agent community to essentially end the practice of gazumping, which I think would be big favorites amongst many people. Anyone who's ever been gazumped, it's not a very pleasurable experience and not a very cheap experience either. So that's just kind of flavor of what's coming up for us in terms of investing.
One thing I noticed, Keelan, when you provided kindly a comprehensive rundown of some of your portfolio companies, you refer to them as we, which suggests that you're deeply ingrained with the companies. So what does that look like in practice? You know, what sort of support do you offer your companies when you've made an investment? What's the sort of day-to-day interaction look like with the companies that you've invested in?
Well, I don't even notice myself saying we, but I suppose that's a good sign because that's how we feel. We want to work with the companies. So sometimes that's easier and sometimes that's more difficult. But the only companies that we're not very hands-on are companies that we've kind of either given up on or that have grown to have other investors that are really leading the charge. But most of our companies, to be honest with you, it's usually when something's going wrong where you really get involved with the company. And sometimes that's, you know, involved in, you know, either hiring or removing people or restructuring. It could be anything from just normal board minutes. It can be providing follow-on investing. It can be finding other investors. It can be, you know, sometimes advising on legal matters, and that can be employment tribunals or that can be IP. You know, all these are all things that we have experience in. And most companies, when they're starting off, an EIS type company, or not even starting off, they can be 5-10 years old, actually, but very few people have every single skill set. And most of them are technology people, a mix of either technologists with people who've worked with technology or maybe more on the business side. But, you know, they may not know much about employment tribunals, and we help them there. So we do work with these companies. And I think that's a big reason why we have such a low failure rate. And even if it goes up, as I suspect it will, to sort of 15% or a little bit higher, that's excellent in the context of most startups. 80% of them fail. So I think that active management is really what kind of explains the failure rate. And it explains why we have a pretty good portfolio return. If you look at, like you do with all private equity, unrealized gains and realized gains. We had one year, I think it was 2017-18, pretty early in our life, where we, you know, the return is not heading towards the 285 at present, although they do have some good companies. And that was because I think 40% of the company, two companies failed. But back then, we were only given exposure to five investors because we weren't raising that much money. But aside from that, we're pretty well on course in terms of realized and unrealized gains for that 285 figure. But, you know, that 285 figure, to put that in context, when you consider that on EIS on £100, you get 30% tax relief, that's basically, if we hit that target, four times, you know, the amount of your original investment tax-free. And not many investments beat that.
Certainly a very strong metric there. So, of course, you know, we touched on there, Keelan, the risk management side of things. And this is something that's always important for investors, whichever investment that they're looking at. You mentioned at the beginning diversification. It'd be really, really good to get a little bit more insight there into, you know, how you diversify the fund. Is it a case of number of holdings? Is it a case of looking at different subsectors within technology there? What's the process that you go through there to make sure that there is a high level of diversification within the funds?
Well, it's kind of a mixture of those two things. On one hand, we try and succeed in giving investors at least 10 companies, sometimes a little bit more, like 10, 12 or 13 or whatever. Possibly occasionally 9 or something, but 10 tends to be a minimum. We certainly would never just give exposure to 5 or 6. So that diversification, but you want diversification, but not too much diversification. So when I look at particularly the VCT market, the venture capital trust market, and I see a portfolio with 200 companies in it, I go, well, you're not doing much to those companies, which is maybe why VCT returns haven't been so good of late, some of the big players anyway. So you want diversification, but not too much diversification. But then within the diversification, you don't want everything in insurtech, for instance, or everything in HR tech. You want to diversify within the subsectors. And I think, as I mentioned before, another central pillar of our risk management is continual due diligence. And that's only possible if you have the active involvement of the fund managers. So typically when we're investing in a company, we have four investment managers, and all of us take the lead on some investments, and we'd have a seconder. But we all get together and then talk through our portfolio. We're monitoring our portfolio, and then we're meeting our portfolio, and we're sometimes, you know, they're spread around the country. So we'll go off to Nottingham, or we'll go off to Bath or wherever it is. Belfast, we have a few companies. We're continually working on that, on the risk management. It's at the fore. I mean, when you think of financial services, where I've spent 35 years of my life, the raison d'etre of financial services is risk management. So it's something that's in our DNA.
What does that process look like, Keelan? Because, of course, you know, you're looking at individual companies and the merits of those companies. What does the decision-making process look like? Because, of course, you mentioned that you've got a number of team members going out and finding opportunities. How do you then whittle those down to 10, 9, 12, whatever it may be, individual companies, whilst maintaining that level of diversification across the different sectors? I mean, you might go out and find 7 really good RegTech companies, for example, that you really like the look of. What does that process look like then to then make sure that you're bringing other ones in that maybe weren't top of the list to start with, if you're trying to look at that diversification there?
Well, to use your example, if we were looking at 7 RegTech and maybe more than that, and we were looking for an addition to our portfolio, and we chose one, if we pass over the other 6, it's probably unlikely that we would come back and invest in the middle of the later date. But what we do then, the one that we do choose, it becomes like our favorite son or daughter, if you like, and we work with them, we try to get them to the next stage. Now, sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't, or sometimes they need help for a while and then they don't, and sometimes they get a new, and we have a number of companies that are getting some third-party investors that are a lot, you know, that's sort of the next stage, Series A, Series B investments. So it really depends on each one, but we really are working with companies. We know what their capital requirements are, and then sometimes we don't believe they need that much money or that much money now, because we've always got to think about dilution of investors as well. We're very concentrated on the efficiency of capital allocation.
So, of course, the aim of the game with EIS funds, Keelan, is to achieve exits. And that's something that Cinven does. And am I correct in thinking, is it 6 exits that you've had? 5 or 6 so far?
That is correct.
So it'd be good if you could run through those, the types of deals that were done for those particular exits. But also, Keelan, how's that shaped your investment process? What have you learned from those exits that you've then put back in to your investment approach for then looking at new investment opportunities?
Well, you know, the exits come in like people in all shapes and sizes. So our first exit was a company called Bynum Butler, which was our first investment. And that one we sold to the company I mentioned earlier, Right Indem. And they basically had technology that Right Indem wanted. And that was an all paper exit. Now, most, if you look at large company M&A activity, you know, NASDAQ or FTSE 100 or whatever, most M&A activity is a mixture of cash to investors of the target company and paper. Sometimes it's all cash, sometimes it's all paper, but it's usually some sort of mix. And we've had a mix of both, and in that case, it was all paper. But let me just give you 2 brief examples of 2 exits, one that came off quite nicely for investors and one that came off nicely in the context. And I'll explain what I mean by that. So one of them, I think it was about 2.5-3 years ago, we sold. It was an early investment of ours. And it was, I think with tax relief, we got, I think it was 2.2 or 2.5 times their return tax-free. Now, that one took a bit longer to happen. It was, I think it was 8.5 years, 9 years. But, you know, we got there in the end. And investors were very happy. And that was an all-cash exit. And another one that was all-cash was a company called Bavica, which we sold to Santander. And Santander has launched their product as a product. And Bavica is kind of funny because it really kind of gives you a flavor of what could be and, you know, great potential. And then in this case, investors got money back, but not all of it. So they, I think on the early investors got 91p on the pound back. But we did sell it to Santander. And really what it was doing is, again, in the area of cybersecurity, allowing insurer companies to properly price writing cybersecurity insurance for small and medium-sized enterprises. And that could be like rather sizable law firms or hospitals or what have you, but not for the JP Morgans of the world. They have their own cyber people. But a lot of people are very vulnerable. Now, within 3 months of investing in our first investment in them, we had Munich Re decide they wanted to buy us. And we were just thinking, wow, this return is going to be a monster. And there was a lot of due diligence done. And it was going to be a global undertaking. So there was like cybersecurity people in Latin America, Asia Pac, etc., all over the globally. Now it ended up the guy who was the sponsor, and anyone who's worked in a large enterprise knows how this works. The sponsor left and the exit didn't happen. And so we had an exit later on. We didn't get everyone's money back, but we got a lot of it back. So a bittersweet exit, I would call that one. The first one will be a successful exit. And then there's been some other ones as well.
I want to start bringing it all together now, Keelan. A very insightful conversation. Thank you very much. And just if we could frame what we've discussed in the principles that Cinven Capital has. You know, these may be written down, these may be unwritten, but when you're looking for investments, what are your guiding principles? And also when you're working with founders after the investments, what's your really top level guidance points that you have across the organization?
Well, we say our primary duty care to investors, I mean, we have a duty to care to founders as well, and we work with them and hopefully productively. But for investors, our overarching principles are, one, we're focused on trying to get that 285 performance. That's point number one. Point number two, we're totally transparent. Point number three, we don't charge investors fees unless we're successful. And as I mentioned earlier, if you give us £100, we don't take any carry. That's the only fee. Well, it's not a fee, it's carry. But we don't take that unless we give you back your entire money. And that's not everybody who does that. We're also very into honest reporting. It's why one of the top panels in the country that we're on, and one of the reasons I think we got on there, was that we would mark positions down where we thought they were going the wrong way. And sometimes it could get marked up again. But usually if you start seeing something slide, and the reason we do that is A, to be transparent, and B, to give investors a bit of a warning. You know, this one's not working out so well. So those are our principles of investors. Our principles with entrepreneurs is basically to hopefully have a full and frank relationship with them where we work with them. And our team has quite a varied skill set. I mean, there's a Venn diagram where we all, you know, are equally strong. But then there's other areas where someone's a bit better at legal matters, someone's a bit better at commercial matters, etc. And so we think we bring a pretty good package to entrepreneurs, and that they're not just getting capital. Now, some people just want capital. They don't want anybody's help or interference, as they would say it, but that's not the kind of company we like working with. Either we don't think it's in the interest of the investor or the entrepreneur.
Just as a note to listeners, if you would like to know a little bit more about the EIS Fund and how you can get involved, please do check out the notes to this podcast, because there'll be a link through to the Sinvan Capital EIS Fund page on Republic, where you'll be able to find more information and make an allocation if you should wish to do so. But as a final point now, Keelan, people that are looking at EIS this year, of course, it's not too long now until the deadline. That will come up very quickly. What would you say to them that differentiates Sinvan from other options out there? And why is now a good time to consider your particular funds?
I think if you're a Republic investor, you've got until the 20th of March to invest, and that will allow you to get invested this size of the tax year. So if you want carry back, because you know you can carry back income to last year, or just to have it invested this year. But there's a lot of funds out there who would invest over a 12 to 18 month period, and we will have it invested before the end of the tax year. We have four investments per year, every 3 months effectively, and we get your certificates back usually within 6 weeks to 2 months. So that's important for a lot of people who are doing their taxes. If you want to come in directly to Sinvan, we need money's cleared in our account by the 27th of March, so the following Friday, and you will get allocated in this tax year. So I think we have better performance than most. I mean, we were rated out of 60 companies, number three. Now, that's about 2 years old, so it might be a bit outdated, but I don't think it would be much change. We have better performance. We have more transparency. We don't charge investors fees. And we only take aggregate carry, aligning ourselves with the investors. In short, that's why you should go, you know, invest with Sinvan.
Thank you very much. So just as a final note to listeners, please do check out the notes to this podcast, because there'll be a link through to the Republic page, but there'll also be a link through to Sinvan Capital's website where you'll be able to get further information. So Keelan, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much to everyone for listening.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.